You guys did a wonderful job of teeing me off perfectly for the talk I wanted to give tonight. I want to talk about equanimity, this teaching on equanimity, but more specifically mindfulness and equanimity and how they're really meant to be integrated into each other. And so just in a very general way, when we, just even in the culture and our colloquial way of thinking, when we think of mindfulness, mostly what we think of is present time awareness. That's sort of the primary component that we sort of privilege. It's like mindfulness is about being in the moment. And there's tons of books about that, and there's a whole line of thinking about that. And that's fine. That is a component of mindfulness. But then there's this other component of mindfulness, which is equanimity. So when we look at mindfulness, when we break it down, the two components we're really looking for is mindfulness, present time awareness, am I here, and do I have equanimity in this moment? Because I don't know about you, present time awareness a lot of times not so great. I find myself wanting to switch to mindfulness off much of the time. Mindfulness of line at the DMV, no thank you. Mindfulness of airport, no thank you. You know, mindfulness of a whole bunch of things I actually tend to want to check out, or I reach for my little digital distractor. You know, and you go out and call, you know, you see, if you go online anywhere, everybody's staring at their phones all the time, it's like glued to the thing. And so mindfulness of present time awareness is really not enough. It's maybe half. So we want to cultivate present time awareness, but we also want to cultivate equanimity, mindfulness and equanimity, and that really becomes sort of the default mode network we're looking for. And I'll talk more about equanimity because it's a complicated concept. But in a very general way, it's I'm here and it's okay to be here. I'm in this present moment experience and I'm at ease. Could things be better? Yeah, sure, maybe. Put my preference system aside. I'm here, I'm engaged. I feel, in sixth grade biology terms, homeostatic. My breathing is natural. I feel it in my body, I feel present. And that's kind of what we're looking for. And they even did a research study around these two things and they found that people performed much better. The equanimity camp performed much better than just the present time awareness. So it's interesting that we've so privileged this idea of being present. But we don't, to the question I was asked earlier, there is this present time, but then there's this big question of how am I? How am I in this present time awareness? And what's my relationship to this experience? And that really changes the game. And so when we think about equanimity, there's lots of ways to talk about it, but I think one of the ways, that's a simple way to begin if you're not familiar with the term, is it's actually sort of the Buddhist perspective on life, on the world. It's this kind of wide, wide view of both and. That life is both tragic and beautiful. And that's always true. Right? It's this kind of both and radical perspective that we live in this embodied experience of beauty and tragedy, pleasure and pain, gain and loss, status and disgrace, praise and blame, all these kind of polarized things. Right? And so that's not an easy concept for the untrained mind to grasp. Because we really like, you know, sort of the black and white, it's either like this or it's either like that. Either I had a good meditation or I had a bad meditation. I had a good day, I had a bad day. I'm good at my job, I'm not good at my job, whatever. These really kind of quick and dirty assessments that we give of things that are very, kind of really overgeneralized. That doesn't have an appreciation or really an awareness of how complex things are. So we really kind of open to this view that life is both and. And I think this is really actually an optimistic view. Buddhism gets its bad rep as sort of being like the bummer of religion because there's so much talk of suffering. And the Buddha's kind of like that. He has sort of his style. He's sort of a bad news first kind of guy. You know, he's like almost all the lists top off with like, all right, man, there's dukkha, there's stress, there's suffering. Because a lot of times we just have so much denial of that. But that's sort of how it gets laid out, that a lot of times, sometimes we get stuck in that. In fact, I have a lot of friends in other Buddhist traditions who call what we do grim vipassana. They're like, oh, you're one of those grim Duke of Vipassana guys. And I'm like, that's not fair. That's an overgeneralization. And I'm like, yeah, I kind of am. But this kind of overemphasis on sort of the negative or the difficult, right? And this is why, like, when we look at, so we have this view of equanimity, but then we actually really have this whole metta component, these practices. And so when we look at, like, standard mindfulness teachings, when mindfulness is practiced and cultivated and brought into its full fruition, it sort of arrives in this experience of equanimity, this balanced impartiality where we acknowledge the complexity of life and we're able to move through the world in a way that feels balanced because we know that the rug can get pulled out from underneath us at any time. And also the Brahma-Vihara practices, which I'm sure you're familiar with, the heart practices, the metta practices, also when they're practiced and cultivated and brought into their full fruition, they also arrive in the experience of equanimity. Right? So they both lead in the same way. And the reason I like to teach metta vipassana is because it actually integrates the two at the same time. And so when we look also too at the both and, we look at, you know, there's a wisdom side of equanimity, and then there's a compassion side. We oftentimes think of Buddhism as wisdom and compassion as kind of a nice, easy way to talk about the practice. But also, too, I think as a culture in sort of our American knowledge-based seeking, having all the answers, we've put a lot of stock in the wisdom category. Right? We think if we just know, if we just understand, if we have all the right answers, if we understand the nature of the mind, or whatever it is that we're trying to understand, we think that that knowledge is somehow going to have a profound shift on the way that we view the world and ourselves. And it might to some degree. But I find it actually, for me, it's been very limited. You know, I was like, once I understand the 12 links of dependent origination, and then once I learned it and studied it and I was able, I wasn't any happier. You know? A lot of this Dharma stuff gets like that and we think, oh, I just want to learn and read and understand. And then you do and you're like, okay, like I still hate being in traffic. You know, and I still, you know, I'm still kind of behaving in the same way. And I don't want to dismiss that or devalue that. I think that wisdom and understanding and those things can be very, very important and very, very useful. But I think that we tend to over-privilege that component of practice, the sort of intellectual technique. And then the other camp, which sometimes is called compassion, really probably from the Theravada, it's more metta, these metta practices, is really kind of this relational way that how we are in the world. How am I? So there's the present time awareness, what's happening, and then there's how am I responding, behaving, holding, relating to this moment in a way that feels supportive, which is a whole different type of training and a whole different type of training because it's not about knowing things actually so much. It's about being able to have a vulnerable, authentic relationship to our experience. A lot of it has to do with other people. When I think of the dichotomy of tragedy and joy, some of the most beautiful things in my life have been my relationship with another human. And some of the most difficult, tragic, especially when you add death and stuff to the equation. So people carry this whole wide range, right? Like there's the loss of someone that we really, really love that's important to us. And then there's the meeting of somebody that we really, really love that we never met before. And this is like going to be going on the whole time. That's not going to stop. Right? And so we really, really want to start with, we start at home, right? We really need to if we really want to cultivate the heart, we have to start with ourselves. We need to learn. We want to learn how to have a kind and friendly relationship to ourselves. If I don't have it with myself, the chances I'm going to have it with somebody else is going to be difficult. And so the compassion side of it, or the metta side of it, is, you know, we try to recognize that this kind, benevolent, metta, loving kindness, as it's often called, is very appropriate towards all experiences. But it also has a kind of a transformative quality. So when we're in a relationship or a moment of experience, a present time experience where there's pain and there's loss and there's difficulty, then that metta really needs to bring up this karuna, this compassion. So it's kindness and compassion in that experience. Somebody that I care about gets a really bad diagnosis or some bad news, or I'm with somebody who's really struggling, then I want to be able to be kind, but I also want to have compassion. I want to be able to feel with them. I want to be able to help if I can. You know, then in that moment, the mindfulness and equanimity becomes more of a compassion. And so we have to cultivate that muscle as well. And we really have to have compassion for ourselves. And that acknowledges this sort of, you know, the minor key of the Dharma, if you will, this sort of sad loss that life is, you know, we've all had our fair share of hardships and struggle. And we can hold that with some degree of compassion without falling into overwhelm or sorrow or depression or, you know, these kind of experiences which are so likely to happen. But what about all the good times? What about the pleasant? What about the joyous and so much of that, right? Well, that's, we have this metta mudita, this kind of metta with appreciative joy, it's often called. Lately, I've just been using the word gratitude because it really just feels like gratitude to me. To being able to participate in the joy of the world without it needing to be mine. Like for us to really have gratitude or appreciation only for our own success and our gain, that means we're robbing ourselves of opportunities to participate in all of the joy in the world, because if it's not mine, then I feel closed off, I feel jealous, I feel envy, which is sort of the oftentimes the dark side of this, the lack of that appreciative joy. It usually manifests as jealousy or envy. We don't appreciate somebody else's success or gain or happiness. We feel jealous that they have it. That sort of how come them and not me attitude, which our culture loves that one. When looking at what other people have, comparing my insides against everybody else's outsides, as if that was had any benefit. So if we can kind of do this little game of, you know, and then the equanimity comes in, we actually are able to acknowledge in a given moment experience, the present time mindfulness. Equanimity kind of gives us some data, it gives us some information. It's like, okay, there's something going on here that I need to pay attention to. There's something going on in the relational field that is calling for a sense of kindness or a sense of compassion or a sense of gratitude. And so we kind of have to. And this will keep you very busy if you try to check this one out. Because what happens, I think, also with the knowing. Me and Floyd were talking about this earlier. About this, Bhikkhu Anālaya has this book, the Satipatthana, which is kind of the revered Buddhist text of the day. Which is sort of the Buddhist teachings on the four foundations of mindfulness. Which is really great and really detailed and very lovely. It's kind of a user's guide, a first person's user's guide to kind of the mind-body system. And so we practice the four foundations of mindfulness. It's a very common and very important. It's kind of the, I would call it the current sort of insight Bible. Everybody's been very excited about it, and it's kind of, it's very trendy in this kind of world. It's been that way for a while. And I've practiced it, I teach it, I think it's great. But I think what happens is it really does kind of focus on this wisdom, understanding, where it's like really taking you through objects of experience. So it's kind of the Buddhist first person user's manual to direct experience, right? Which is great because it gives us a sense of how our system operates. How do I bring, what is my relationship to the body, the feelings, the mind states, the dhammas, the really everything. It categorizes everything. It's actually kind of brilliant the way it's laid out. However, there's not much, there's plenty of it implied. There's a lot of implicit kind of, you know, kindness, positivity, But the Satipatthana doesn't have this other side of it so much. These heart practices, the loving kindness and the compassion and the gratitude. There's unfortunately no sort of Brahma Vihara Satipatthana. And so what happens is, again, we kind of end up privileging that side of it, the sort of scholastic wisdom, knowing side of it. And I think the reason why it makes it so hard, and I think it's so relevant, this conversation is so relevant in our time, it's because I don't live in a monastery. I'm not a monastic. I don't have 227 precepts that I follow in a whole huge community that's supporting me. I live in the world where I have, you know, all the external demands that you have. Family demands, financial demands, civic demands, all kinds of responsibilities. Parental. And so this really is trying to encourage me to pay more attention to this sort of relational domain. So how am I in my relationships with other people? Do I have people in my life that I can talk to? Do I have a support system? How many people do you actually have in your life that you can sit down with and tell them just about anything? If you have two or three of those people, you're very lucky. You know, we live in a culture where we have to go pay $250 an hour to sit in a therapist's office with a closed door and a noise machine on the other side of the door so we can talk about how hard it's been. Which I have done and do and find it very valuable. But it's interesting that we've kind of don't have this relational experience, which is why I think you're so lucky and so wonderful to have a community of practitioners who are at least practicing in a similar vein and similar practices. And the other thing too that we don't see in that classic teaching is sort of the relational experience that we're in, and also what's always sort of gets complicated, and that is emotional, which is what I'll talk about tomorrow night. But really trying to learn how to navigate and to really bring mindfulness and equanimity to relationships with the people in our lives, and also really having some awareness and some respect and some kind of skills around managing and understanding emotion. Because that is such a huge component of our lives that kind of sometimes hovers below the surface of conscious awareness. And this kind of emotional intelligence of being able to understand different emotions have different impacts on the way we think and what we think about. When I'm angry, the type of thinking that goes on in my mind is very different than when I'm sad. I have a whole different kind of thinking that goes on when I'm sad. And so I almost feel like I have this emotional autobiography that different ways that I find myself in different moments of my life, I have this running narrative. Do you have a running narrative in your mind about you being a person in the world and how well it's going? And they call it the self. Apparently there is a not self, but I don't see it that often. Like this kind of running kind of, you know, narrative dialogue that's kind of keeping things going. And a lot of that, the way that we feel about ourselves is based on the emotions that we're feeling or not feeling. Because some of us would just prefer to actually numb the whole emotional system out and just be done with it. Which I think is one of the dangers, I think it's one of the, can be one of the side effects of this kind of practice. Sometimes it's called now a spiritual bypass, where we don't intentionally sit down to sort of have a spiritual bypass, but it's happened to me before, where I kind of can use my concentration practice, or I can use some of the skills that I develop in my mindfulness practice actually as a tool to repress feelings that I don't want to feel, which on the fly can come in quite handy. Right? It's not all bad. But there's this way in which we can kind of have this cutoff. And what they talk about in equanimity also is the near enemy, which is something that looks like equanimity that's not equanimity at all. That's why it's a near enemy. And it's this kind of indifference, this attitude, this kind of cold indifference of just like, you know what, whatever, it's all just a big nothing. Like, you know, this kind of really cold, which can sometimes look and feel like wisdom, you know, this kind of emptiness, it's all just empty phenomenon. But when you're having an argument with your wife, that's not the right perspective. Right? Doesn't always work so good. So we can kind of create these, you know, these side effects, which are not intentional, but can happen for sure. And a lot of us, you know, I know for me, like I came to Dharma practice to some degree to try to like bypass or avoid. I did have feelings and emotions and experiences in my life that I thought the practice was going to like get rid of or like fix or like make all better now or something. I found the opposite has been true. And I have varying opinions about how I feel about that. But I think that we, in this kind of conversation that's been sort of happening in this world a little bit around spiritual bypass, it's like, I think to some degree we really, Dharma practice really brings us right into the truth and the reality and the limitations of our humanity. Right to the raw, you know, visceral experience, and trains us and teaches us how to really operate as best we can, knowing that we have some hardware, we've got some hardwired stuff going on here that's not going to go away, but we also can develop this way of relating to our experience that will change the way we feel, the way we see things, our view about ourselves and our view about the world. I've noticed it happens real slow. I don't know if you ever had this experience, but I've been at this for a long time, and sometimes I feel like for the amount of work I've put in my recovery and my Dharma practice, and I'm like, I should be like way better than I am. I got like $100,000 worth of like stuff. I should be farther. Do you ever feel like I should be farther down the trail by now? Right. And I think a lot of it comes down to the fact that we do have to, we see that a lot of it, a lot of the work that needs to be done and a lot of the things that happen in the practice is really quite unpleasant. You know, and a lot of what mindfulness shows us, I know for me, has showed me lots of things about my own mind that I really don't want to look at. You know, shines a light on sort of the ways in which I'm in denial about probably a whole range of things. And so then what happens is we want to be able to bring that out of the subconscious, out of the not knowing, into the knowing, and then kind of liberate that. Right? And so just every time it comes in, we just smack it back, get out of here. Mm-hmm. You know, the aversion is not a very useful liberation tool. Right? And so then we can kind of see that there's the when the unknown becomes unknown, and we can actually have it, see it as an object and work with it, like, you know, contemplatively, meditatively, we find that we can really transform these parts of ourselves. You know, and I think much of that work for me has really been done in this side of equanimity that's really in this relational kind. It's hard to talk about, I think, because for me, one thing that I believe is sometimes they use this word spiritual. I don't like that word so much. I prefer to use the word nonverbal. And I think much of the Brahma Vihara practice is there's a component, there's actually, I think, a really beautiful component of Dharma practice that's largely nonverbal. Like you just, there's just no way that it can be transmitted through language. Which is why I think sitting quietly by ourselves and doing this work is so valuable, because there's some nonverbal stuff going on. And actually, largely, a lot of our emotional experience is nonverbal. So I think that there's a kind of a mystery component to it that I actually really kind of trust. You know, I really trust this nonverbal part of it because I know that the benefits have been there. And I truly believe that when I sit quietly by myself and close my eyes and bring my attention to my breath, that something is happening that's going to benefit me. And I don't need to pin it down. I don't need to name it. It's just sort of this trust. The Buddha talks about sada, this sometimes called faith. I like the word trust better myself. that there's something about this practice that feels very trustworthy. And that for me has been the greatest motivator to continue. I don't know what it is. I can't pin it down. I'm not 100% convinced that it's true. But I'm pretty sure this is the right way to go about things. So I think I'll leave it at that. Thank you for your kind attention this evening, and I will be happy to have any questions you might have about the talk or anything that I've said. Yes, please.
I am.